Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
It's time for the writers. M. Russiano. She's a writer, singer, podcaster, comedian. She was first introduced to Australian audiences on the second season of Australian Idol as a young stay-at-home mom who happened to have an incredible voice. M came ninth in the show and at the start of a career behind a microphone. Whether it be breakfast radio, stand-up comedy, or her incredibly popular podcast, or even her National Press Club address that went viral. In the past 6 years, M has received two life-changing diagnoses. Add in the hormonal influxions of perimenopause, and it's not been easy for M. And that's an understatement. She's written about it in her new memoir, Blood, Sweat and Glitter, a coming of middle age story. And she's back behind the microphone for you now. Em, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you for having me. Nightlife. It sounds saucy.
It is sometimes saucy.
Is it though? Isn't this the ABC?
Yeah, you should see the text line sometimes.
You should start an Instagram account with just the ABC Nightlife text lines. Wipe out people's numbers, but that would go off. I would definitely follow the ABC Nightline text line. That would be amazing.
It would. I'll keep that in mind.
Good.
Look, there are plenty of coming of age stories about the messy, daunting, thrilling stage of where you go from childhood to young adulthood.
Yeah.
But you've picked up on calling your memoir a coming of middle age story.
Mm.
Have we completely overlooked that phase of life, that transition from being, like, quote, young in your 30s to, quote, middle age?
Yes. And it's going to shock you to know it's because it really only affects women. Because if men went through, it's reverse puberty. So all the things that happen to you in puberty happen in reverse in perimenopause. And it's just as discombobulating and disconcerting and you feel just as unhinged. But we are way more patient with hormonal teenagers. Oh, they're just going through a phase. Don't worry, the door slamming, the crying, the anger. I'm going through that again at 46. But, it's just another women's health situation that has been overlooked. But not on my watch, is what I say.
Well, what does middle age like look like to you? Like, obviously, it's nothing like you expected by the sounds.
No, this whole situation, because for me, perimenopause started in my late 30s and I didn't know. And if you had have mentioned anything to do with menopause to me in my 30s, I would have looked at you like, I'm not an old lady. Like, I'm not a wizard. I'm not a witch. Come back to me when I'm 100. I had no idea. But it did all start from in my late 30s, which it can do for a lot of women in AFAB. So, it's completely different, and it's been this exfoliation of my entire sense of self, and the hormone that kind of runs everything in your body from your brain to your heart to your lungs all of a sudden starts leaving. And I was looking around at other women, thinking, "Are we supposed to just shut up about this?" Because our mums did. The boomers were told, and the builders before them were told to just shut up and get on with it. And a lot of them felt broken and like they weren't coping and they didn't understand that it was biological and nothing they could help. And now my generation, if anyone thought we were going to take this sitting down, they were sadly mistaken. And it does feel like now, oh, it's a fad, it's a phase, everyone's talking about it. But this is just a correction of years of neglect on this topic because it affects half the population, James. It's not a niche issue.
No.
And we all know and care about somebody with ovaries or are a person with ovaries. So it's massive and life-changing and it affects families and workplaces everywhere. If the woman you're around who is, say, over 40 suddenly can't stand the way you chew, there's a reason and it's a biological one. And that was what I became obsessive about and why I wanted to write the book so everybody could understand this better.
Yeah. You said on this week that you were hanging by a thread every time you sat down to write this book. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of just answered the question there, but what kept you going, even though it was just so hard for you to get done?
This book cracked me open in ways, you know, and I've made a career out of tackling the hard stuff of life, trying to shine a bit of light in the dark places and talk about subjects that are usually not spoken about in stand-up comedy. And when I was in the thick, in the midst of perimenopause, and it was also lockdowns in Melbourne, and my marriage was really breaking down and has since broken down, and this is happening for so many people, and this book was a way for me to process everything that was happening in my life. It was almost like trauma release. And the book is the most honest, matter-of-fact, unmasked me I've ever been, and that was the whole point of it is, you know, I've been lots of different versions of M. I've been the singer M and radio M, and, you know, I've built all these personas. And in somewhere in there, I lost myself. But this book was almost a coming home and a walking back to me and who I want to be. And yeah, many times I walked away from it and said to my publishers, I can't. It's too hard. And I wrote it through, the marriage breaking down, my son starting prep, hormonal hellscape, finding out I'm autistic. It's been huge. And I just want everyone to know I've just poured everything in there, but I've also given you solutions and answers and information because I didn't want to set anyone off into an anxiety tailspin.
Yeah.
So you'll never have to go on Google either. I've given you literary Google. Every time I mention something, yes. Anytime I mention something.
You've got the text boxes there.
Mm-hmm, I understand ADHD. I know my crowd. You will all get distracted and head off online and forget about the book. But
I feel like that you had that in mind though when you were writing it. You know, this is I want this to be for ADHD people. They don't need to go elsewhere. If I've said something that needs to explaining, here is a textbook and here's a pretty picture.
Yes, but not only that. When the ADHDer passively aggressively gives the book to the parent or the partner and says, "Read this," the parent or the partner will also get the information. Mm. So it's kind of like a love letter to people like me and a roadmap for people who love people like me. It's kind of the book for everybody to understand what's happening, be the person neurodivergent or going through perimenopause and menopause, or, you know, just a woman of a certain age, with all that entails.
You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. M. Rossiano is with you. Her new memoir is Blood, Sweat and Glitter. I'm James Finlay. And let's get into some of the content of the book, some of the themes. The time you had in breakfast radio is no secret.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the toxic time you had, your time in Perth doing brekkie was bad. But in your book, you say that the worst 2-odd years of your life for when you were hosting Sydney Today, Today at Femme Breakfast. Mm-hmm. You're not alone in that. Other women have talked about their commercial radio environments and it being horrendous. Why is that? And when will there be a reckoning?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the reckoning because I don't know that many people care enough about commercial radio anymore. I think, you know, 80s and 90s was the heyday of the big shock jocks and they were on millions of dollars a year and there was really no other alternatives. But why so many women get, you know, chewed up and spat out is because they caught smart, fierce, opinionated, switched on women who have really high standards, and then when we're that off air, it's very inconvenient to the men who run the station who want us just to do what we're told. And especially when you work in Sydney media, those very powerful men find ways to try and control you, bring you down a peg. And they were doing that to me via feeding stories to the press that weren't true, by undermining me behind my back. It was just all these kind of Machiavellian games that just were considered part and parcel of radio, and they really make you believe that you're the problem, you're the squeaky wheel, just go along with this stupid stunt or go along with this inappropriate sponsor. And I'm somebody, and because I'm autistic ADHD, when I see a problem, I just say it out loud.
Mm.
Like I'm kind of very direct, and also I want the best for everything. And also my name's on the show. So if something isn't good or something comes off as, you know, lightly racist, it's not the producer that lined the segment up who gets dragged. It's me. And I only get one M. Rossiano. Mm. So I would fiercely protect that. And as a result, you know, was labelled a diva and difficult and, you know, can't work with her and all the things, and then you start to believe it about yourself. But now I know I was in the worst possible place for someone with my neurotype, and just it, the toxic boys club of radio, of television, of the entertainment industry at large is well known. And I think we are reaching a point where badly behaved men will be outed, and I look forward to that. I will be third on the pile if it begins, not first or second. Whistleblowers never come out well, but
well, when's that article coming out? You talked about a journo, a very well-respected journo, yeah, if I remember correctly, in the book.
Yes.
Has written something.
Well, she hasn't written it. She
just push print.
Know. There's a pivotal moment that happened to me that helped me really reconcile that time, because I held a lot of shame about it when a reporter rang and said, you know, that she's investigating commercial radio, and I have spoken to her since, and it got squashed by very powerful people, but she's still got a bee in her bonnet about it. So I hope one day it happens. Yeah.
The truth comes out. Well, one thing that came out of this is you being able to essentially do what you want, which is wild. And one of my favourite stories in the book, Em, is when you walk into entertainment magnate Michael Gudinski's office.
No one's asked me about this. That's good. You're the first.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah.
And you're telling him exactly what you want. I was flicking through those pages.
Yeah, yeah.
You wanted a musical comedy show. You wanted all the bells and whistles. You wanted the smoke machines, the glitter, everything in true Em style. Where did you source your power to get what you want like that?
I think part of being neurodivergent especially is being drawn to scary situations. And, you know, when I was asking for all of this at the time, I didn't know I was neurodivergent, but, you know, it's like I walk towards things most people would run a mile from. And I just knew I was capable of putting on something different. The Australian comedy scene for a long time has been kind of the straight white guy with the checkered shirt talking about failed relationships, you know, with a bar stool and a glass of water, yeah, in front of a brick wall. And when I first got into comedy, a lot of those types of comedians really railed against me and would say I'm not a real comedian because I have music and people have to clap and why am I wearing a leotard on stage? And I just kind of exited from the comedy community at that point and started my own corner of the universe. But I knew it would work because, to me, Australia loves camp. We love Kylie. We love Pink. You know, like, Pink has a bigger career here than in America, yeah, because we love Kath and Kim. We love Priscilla. And to me, stand-up comedy, add in campery and music, because I am a musician, like, why not put every string that I have available on my bow to good use? I don't understand why I was being made to feel like I couldn't use my entire skill set. And once I did that, I knew that the little comedy venues wouldn't cut it. And my management had kind of signed a deal with Gudinski and Frontier Touring, but it was just a very small arm. And I started seeing what they were thinking for me. And I just demanded a meeting with Michael Gudinski, which, you know, I just knew once I got in front of him, we'd work, because he was chaotic and creative, and me too. So I finally got in with him, and it was, we clicked straight away. It was, we spoke the same language. We spoke the same shorthand, and he got it. He saw the vision, and to his credit, you know, it was full steam ahead. And I put on a show at Margaret Court Arena, which we renamed to Mariah Carey Arena, but toward the end of last year. And, like, that is unheard of. A female Australian stand-up comedian with full band doing an arena show is, like, I don't think that's ever happened before. So, yeah, Frontier always backed me in on that. But I backed myself because it just felt like a no-brainer for Australian audiences.
Yeah. What was it like to have that validation from someone who is was one of those big, powerful, straight white men?
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I kind of knew the straight white men I started figuring out the ones that would respond to me.
Yeah, right.
I hate this term so much. It's such a red flag. I have real alpha male energy if I want to.
Yeah, totally, of course you
know.
Do.
Yeah, and so I know how to speak locker room.
Yeah.
I know how to, those men don't intimidate me, but I do intimidate them. Mm. But when I find this term is so gross. I want to vomit. When I find an alpha male who likes me, I get it. Yeah. And, yeah, he was definitely one of those men that enjoyed my big personality and inner power rather than endured it. And once I figured that out, I really exploited it.
that's the
rest
secret.
In peace, yeah. MG. Yeah. Look, he was not a perfect man, and I'm sure people have stories about him and whatever, but for me, he was one of the first real true believers, and what a true believer to have, you know, like what a powerful person to get on side.
And look, we don't want to give too much away. You have to read it in the book, but the way that you described the way you walked into that room.
I'll never forget.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all in the book, but the meeting was quite something. Yeah.
You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. I'm Jane Spindley, and with you is Em Rossiano. She's got a new memoir out, Blood, Sweat and Glitter. And in just a moment, you're going to hear all about the big diagnoses that changed her life.
For many, the cost of living and financial hardship is taking its toll. ABC Local Radio is partnering with OzHarvest to help provide food and comfort to people doing it tough. Donate now at abc.net.au/gives.
On ABC Radio, this is Nightlife with James Finlay.
And tonight with you for your writer's spot is Em Rossiano. She's the author of the brand new memoir, Blood, Sweat and Glitter. You would know her as a writer, singer, podcaster, comedian. She's doing it all. Em, you have had a huge couple of few
years. Had a huge life, James.
Had a huge life.
Everyone keeps saying, what a big week, month, year, life. Yeah. And when you go back and join the dots with hindsight, it's just big things keep happening to me. I'm a magnet for it. It's okay. That's the goddess gives her biggest struggles to her best soldiers, right?
And also, if anyone can cope with it, it's you.
People keep saying that. I'm sick of coping. One day I want to coast. I'm really looking forward to everyone's like, geez, Em is just coasting.
Everything's just so easy for Em Rossiano.
There you go. She's not fighting for her life anymore. Yeah, I look forward to that.
All right, let's talk about your ADHD diagnosis, because look, the pandemic years were tough for most people, except for the point that you make in the book, the people in Perth. But hello to our great listeners in
WA. I love you, Western Australia, yep. But you had a mini break in Melbourne. It was grim. It was 2 years, yeah.
But it kind of helped you realize a path to your ADHD diagnosis. But it wasn't easy to get there, was it?
No, and look, you know, I was also accused of starting the ADHD fad. So, you know, I thought it was time we brought it back.
What just, power?
You know, you're welcome. I think when I started realizing that things were not great, and now I know also I was in perimenopause, which is why a lot of women get diagnosed with ADHD late in life, because when the estrogen starts to leave, the ADHD symptoms really ramp up. So, yeah, I realized something wasn't right, and I went to my doctor, and lucky for me, and women's health in this country is so often down to just having the right GP, and it shouldn't be, but it is. He'd seen some studies about an increase in ADHD diagnoses for women over 40 in the States, and just chucked it in there as a, let's look into that as well with low iron and what's happening with your ovaries. But even then, you know, there's this idea in society before the last couple of years that we only ever really saw 10-year-old white boys bouncing off the walls, Bart Simpson, ADHD. And I was a chronically exhausted 42-year-old mother of three, and you just wouldn't think about it because we just never seen the representation of women with ADHD in mainstream media at all. So I think a lot of women have been turned away. A lot of little girls have been missed because we present differently to boys. We're not hyperactive. We are often quieter in class, and we're masking very hard, and we're trying to be good girls and fly under the radar. So it's hard. I think it's a bit easier now with all the, you know, I did the press club address to try and bring awareness to female presentation of ADHD. In my book, I've got all the diagnostics, but in an easy to understand way. So a lot of people might come into the book wondering if they're neurodivergent, and I wanted to make sure they left knowing if they were or they weren't and what to do about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is still tough in this country as a woman navigating the healthcare system for any sort of diagnosis, because you're put on trial. You have to prove your symptoms, that you're not being hysterical. So, yeah, I think same happened with the autism, the symptom recognition bias. I wasn't presenting as a 10-year-old boy, so therefore I mustn't be autistic or ADHD. So I was turned away the first time I went in for an autism diagnosis. So my great hope is that this book emboldens and empowers women to go and advocate for themselves in the healthcare system. I've given you a script of what to say if you think you're in perimenopause, if you think you're autistic, if you think you're ADHD. I've given you something to take with you to the doctors. You shouldn't have to, but I've done that because had to navigate it. It's really tough.
It's tough. And, you know, women trying to get diagnoses for many things, you know, anything. Endo as well.
Endo, yeah, and all of it that's just fobbed off as part of being a woman. And none of this is natural. Cave women died in their 30s. This is... Well, nothing's been designed for women in, you know, from 35 and over, and that needs to change. And going to the doctors, you should be able to get endo, you should be able to get menopause, you should be able to get mental health stuff diagnosed without feeling like you've got to present to the court and prove it. It's just, we should be believed first visit.
You've become, I think it's accurate for me to say become, but been so much of an advocate for people with ADHD and autism over the past few years. But when you were asked to do the National Press Club address, you initially said no, Em.
Twice. I did.
What made you think that what you... And I'm putting words in your mouth here.
No, it's fine.
What made you think that what you wanted, what they people wanted you to say wasn't good enough for the National Press Club?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm a decidedly unserious person as via my job, and the idea of the press club is the greats have spoken there. I mean, I was there and you're walking down to present and there's a big picture of Gough Whitlam and Julia Gillard, and it's like, no pressure. And I just didn't think that I deserved to occupy that space. And it took me a while to realise that it was just much bigger than any feelings I had of inadequacy. It was the idea that disability in general very rarely gets that kind of platform with that kind of audience, and I needed to get over myself because I'm very passionate about shifting the dial on how society discusses disability, how we treat disabled people, but also claiming my space within the disability community has been... It still is very fraught and nuanced, and I, again, don't present as everyone's preconceived idea of as a disabled woman. And it's still something, you know, I think about, and I chat with Senator Jordan Steele John a lot about. He's been a huge advocate of the ND community, found out his ADHD because of me and his mum. But, yeah, and he's a man who's in a wheelchair, got cerebral palsy, and he said, you are part of our community. You are in the disability community and we welcome you. And, yeah, it's a hard topic to talk on because disability is like a fingerprint, right? It affects everybody differently, and some people are profoundly disabled and some people have lower support needs, and I can't represent all of those people. And that also was plaguing me in accepting the press club because, like I said, disability doesn't get that kind of platform. So everybody, it's kind of like you've got to say all the right things and cover all the bases and represent every single person and not get anything wrong, because if you do, then it gets ruined and no one will do it again. There was so much pressure. Yeah. But then, you know, I got to work with a guy named Ben Crow, who's Ash Barty's kind of mindset coach, who's worked with every elite athlete you can think of. I was lucky enough to kind of work with him before the speech, and he's like, all you can do is tell your story and hope that people see themselves reflected in it. And so that's what I did. I just spoke from my point of view, not for people, just about my story and my son's story. And it did. It helped people see their story, and they were able to take parts of it. And it did move the conversation forward on disability in general in our society.
Yeah, it went viral, Em. Like, how did you feel when you saw... I want to talk more about your impact in a minute, but when you saw that, just the response from that National Press Club address, how did you feel?
It was really humbling. It was not what I expected. I wasn't sure how it was going to hit. I was really scared. But the response, still now people bring it up all these years later. It's really changed my life, and I know changed the lives of lots of people subsequently, who saw it and saw themselves and went to get an ADHD diagnosis or took their children in to be assessed for autism. And I I'm so glad as a performer, as an advocate, when your message lands the exact way you intended it to, it's so fulfilling. Like, it's just hard to explain the feeling that when people get it, because my whole life I've felt misunderstood and mislabeled, and all these assumptions are made about me that aren't true. And for once in my life, 1 + 1 = 2 simply. And it was really great.
And Rossiano is with you here on Nightlife on ABC Radio. Her new memoir is Blood, Sweat and Glitter. I'm James Findlay. And you've got three kids.
Yes.
Your son, Elio, was diagnosed with autism as well.
Mm-hmm.
So how, with these diagnoses that you've got, plus, you know, your son's diagnosis as
all
well.
All three kids are ADHD autistic.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All three of them.
Mm-hmm.
How has your diagnosis changed the way that you parent?
It hasn't. I mean, it's oftentimes now there's still this stigma around especially autism, and a lot of my friends are teachers and they obviously are on the front line and they can see a child who is clearly autistic in their classroom and they approach the parents and, you know, 9 times out of 10 they're met with resistance and anger and shame. And that makes me so sad because the only person that suffers in that circumstance is the kid. For me, an autism diagnosis for Elio was a relief. It was the manual to his brain. Mm. It was a way forward for his life to be easier. And as his parent, that is my absolute number one job. So he got diagnosed as autistic first, and then I saw myself in a lot of the diagnostic stuff. And then did what autistic people do and went and made it my special interest topic and realised, oh, I'm autistic. And I think if anybody is listening now and, you know, maybe the teacher's brought it up with you or you're worried about your child being neurodivergent, I just want to say to you, it's the greatest gift of information and your kid's life will be infinitely better. And for Elio, it's just a contextualiser. He's very obviously autistic. He can't mask. I was able to mask. My daughters have been able to mask, but that's a societal thing. That's what we put on women and girls. But there are some levels of autism that can't be masked, and he has that level of autism. But it's not something that it's weird or shameful. It's just like, well, he's got brown hair, he's got brown eyes, and he's autistic. And what are the supports we need in around that to make things better for him and better for the people around him? And if I can get Australian families to that point with neurodiversity, if I can remove the shame from my generation of parents, if I can make it easier for teachers to approach parents and make those little people's lives better, then I will keep fronting up and keep advocating, because a diagnosis is just like it opens up the world rather than closing it down. And that's what I want for kids. That's what I want for 10-year-old Em.
Yeah.
And my children, and I see how the world isn't set up to be kind to brains that think differently and are different. So, yeah, that's the number one kind of the next thing for me, that frontier, is how parents and teachers can interact so that the parents don't take it as an insult and the kid gets what they need.
How has that helped? Has it helped your kids? Like, I guess they can.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I've always parented in a neurodivergent way, in that yeah. I get very into their interests. We, you know, we all love, the girls and I love the divas and vampires and fantasy, and we get all the merch and we go to the shows, and Elio and I ride into the dinosaurs and Nintendo, and it helps. And I think neurodivergent parenting is going back to the things that you used to love as a kid but maybe felt some shame around, or maybe, you know, you didn't get to do as much of, and introducing them to your kids and then doing it together.
Mm.
It's made me a much better parent. I also stopped comparing myself to neurotypical parents yeah. and my kids to neurotypical kids, because I always felt like I was falling short. But, you know, I was comparing apples to oranges, and now I parent my kids. I mean, my two big girls are 24 and 19. I'm not parenting them. They're parenting me now. Let's be honest.
When I read that, I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe they're that age already.
I know. And they're magnificent humans who know about their brains, who know what supports need to put in. They know when they need to have a rest. And, yeah, with Elio, I'm a much better parent to him than I was to the girls. But, you know, they see me sometimes and they're like, what the hell? Like, I'm so sorry. I did my best with the information I had at the time. But I'm just, I try, and whenever I'm struggling with Elio, and he, you know, he has some support needs, I just try and remember what I would have needed at his age in that moment, and I parent accordingly.
And Rossiano is with you here on Nightlife, and over the last few years, she's built an entire community around her. We'll dive into that in just a moment.
Gloves on, detective, for Julia Zemiro's brand new show.
Which is a show all around crime, the whys, the wherefores and the what not to do's, obviously.
Crime Night with Julia Zemiro starts Wednesday, November 5 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
You're listening to Nightlife with James Findlay on ABC Radio.
And with you tonight is M. Rossiano. She is author of the brand new memoir, Blood, Sweat and Glitter. Look, I've seen firsthand how you being open and honest about your life has affected other people for the better. Whether it's been your ADHD or your autism diagnoses or you talking about perimenopause, I've seen the difference it makes in people's lives. What does that mean to you? Because you've built such a huge community just from being you.
Yeah, I think a lot of my community is made up of people who have felt othered. And it's, you know, the queer community, the neurodivergent community, people of diverse backgrounds. My audience is, you know, a mixed bag of glorious, colourful, passionate, left of centre individuals. Truly, it looks like an art teacher convention, really, when I look out to the crowd. I don't know. I realised halfway through, you know, this media career that I'm in, that mainstream media was not going to be my friend, and I needed to find a way to create my own work. I needed to find a way to cut out these, at the time, it was just straight middle-aged white guys deciding on my career, and they were terrified of me, so I would constantly miss out on work. So I realized, well, I got to go out and find my people and directly connect with them. And I was lucky. I'm good at social media. Social media is really like good and bad for an ADHDer because of the dopamine. And I just started telling the truth, and it started reaching people far and wide, and social media really blew my career up. It was just when Twitter was launching that, you know, I decided that I wanted to find my own community, and I cherish them and value them, and they get first dibs on everything, and I know that I wouldn't have a career without them, and my community get everything first. And, you know, we've been able to have the podcast funded by the community. We have a subscription arm, and they come to my shows, they buy the book, they support me publicly. And I don't know, I just wanted to find all the people that have been made to feel less than and give them a safe space. A lot of people come to my shows on their own and leave with lifelong friendships. I'm so proud of how many people come to my shows solo. It's really hard to make friends in adulthood. The world is lonely. We're all online. We're all a little bit disconnected. And to be able to foster an environment where people feel safe enough to A, come on their own, but then B, make friends is probably the thing I'm most proud of, because I had one friend at high school, and he's still my friend now, Michael Lucas, wrote The Newsreader, obviously, and killed Dr. Patrick on Offspring. I must stop saying that. But I know what it is to not have someone to hang out with at lunchtime if Michael happened to be sick one day, and it was terrifying. So, yeah, the community around me is fierce and loyal and incredible and creative, and just this amazing network of people that I'm hope to keep growing. And maybe we've collected a few tonight on the ABC Nightlife.
I'm sure you have. What would your advice be to those who are still struggling to be themselves? Because I feel like a lot of those people, they're going to you, your shows, your content to get inspiration. What would your advice to be to them?
Well, I asked that same question of Ben Crow before the press club, and I wasn't sure who I was because I'd been so many different versions, and I'd recreated myself to be what everyone else wanted. I didn't really know who I was away from that. And he got me to write down the person I want to be, how I want to walk through the world. And, you know, I said I wanted to be grounded. I wanted to be authentic. I wanted to be loyal. I wanted to be passionate and caring and strong. And, you know, when I saw all those words written down, I realized I am all those things. I just needed to remember that. And every time a decision came my way, would it be pointing me towards those attributes or away from it? And that really simple exercise has helped me make really tough decisions, put in boundaries with people that needed it. But it's made all of that tricky interpersonal stuff easier because I just look at my list of who and how I want to show up and the decision is kind of made that way. So it's a lifelong journey as an adult, you know, figuring out who you are and what makes you happy, especially for women because we're discouraged from doing the things that make us happy. We're told to kind of martyr ourselves for our families and put ourselves on the back burner, and that's incorrect. That's, you must put yourself first, actually, because then you show up as a better mom, a better coworker, a better friend, because you're not completely frazzled and hanging on by a thread and a shell of a human. But it's a, like, never stop learning, keep yourself open, grow at every opportunity you can, even when it's hard, especially when it's hard. I think when we start closing off our worldview and universes, and we're seeing this in America, things get really unpleasant and small and narrow and unkind. But when you stay curious and open, the possibility for change and growth is always there. And it's the staying open part that I would hope your listeners would take away. If you take away nothing else, it's just stay open and curious to everything. And next time you want to blame or get angry, ask questions instead. I find that really helps.
It's been so good to spend time with you tonight. Congratulations on the new memoir, and thank you for being so honest and open with not just tonight's conversation, but in everything you do. I really appreciate your time, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Blood, Sweat and Glitter, a coming of middle age story, is published through Pantera Press and is out now.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.